Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And this episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by GoToMeeting. Earnings week about to begin very shortly. Stocks are moving sideways, and we're going to have to see which way they break out. Oil hits 113, and gold at an all-time high again. And wouldn't you know it, CEO pay is back to the old days and the old highs. Hey, how are you? Andrew Horowitz here. This is episode number 207 on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And it is a delightful day in April. And as I mentioned, this episode is sponsored by GoToMeeting. You know, one of the great things about GoToMeeting that I really do like, and I got to tell you something, if you haven't tried this, you really should check it out, because it makes meetings so simple. It really does. I mean, it makes them kind of just, you click and you have a link and you send the link and then you can share screens. And now all of a sudden, there you are presenting to someone else or many people what you could have done by flying and staying at a hotel. Great service. You can do it, you know, for people in your own company. You could do it for clients and make presentations. What's nice about it, you just schedule an online meeting. It takes no time at all. And the attendees just click, they click, and there you go. Pops up on the screen. There's no like software to install or all that good stuff. It's just really easy to work with. And what I'd like to say, what's really neat about this is that, yes, you can try GoToMeeting for free. You can go to GoToMeeting.com and have a free unlimited use of their service for 30 days. Enter the promo code PODCAST and you get full voice over IP, phone conferencing, all of that, plus this online presentation and this really simple way of creating a meeting online. If nothing else, just try it, okay? If you haven't checked it out, go over to GoToMeeting.com, enter the promo code PODCAST, check it out today. Okay, so we're looking forward to earnings season, which is going to happen this week, because we've kind of been in this sideways market for about the last month or so with a good amount of breakouts, but a lot of disappointing breakdowns as well. Much of that comes on the heels of, I guess, just the concern that we have around the world, right? You know, you have all this uncertainty and you have a lot of doublespeak and misdirection being used by the various Fed speakers around the world. Governments tell you one thing, then they go another way. We'll get into that whole situation with Portugal in a second. And at the same time, you have stocks coming up with some great earnings numbers, and you have still a very accommodative Fed policy. So at the same time, you look at the other side and say, well, wait a minute, we have oil that is just, you know, crazy numbers already. And you have things like the unrest in the Middle East, the European region is all just, you know, a mess. You have the earthquake in Japan, and then the last earthquake in Japan, again, another 7.4 or so hit and knocked out power for about almost a million people are still without power due to that second, as they call it, aftershock. But I think really that was a brand new earthquake, we can call it, because if it was an aftershock, I mean, we're looking in the fives, right? Fives, fours, fives for an aftershock on the Richter scale. We're talking about a 7.4, pretty substantial situation. And wouldn't you know it? Kind of funny as it is, right? So you get this 7.4 and markets around the world, as they were open during the day, Asia was closed, started to trail down and really sell off. And all of a sudden, they kind of just settled out and the Nikkei futures were down about 1%, almost 1% before the Nikkei opened that night. And it opened up down, sure enough, because of the concern. And when they realized it didn't hit the nuclear plants, which have their own ongoing trouble, the Nikkei reversed and finished amazingly up 2%. I mean, the after effect of that secondary earthquake, while it did not do anything to the Fukushima nuclear facility, it surely did cause some problems. Actually, I take that back. It did cause a panic to move out of that. It did cause power outages for the cooling system. It caused them to, you know, work on spilling a lot of the seawater that was 60 million gallons, I think it was, of nuclear-radiated seawater into the Pacific Ocean, just right in there. because I need to get rid of it and make room for some further coolants. But the Nikkei rallied, and that was on the heels of a really depressing Tonkin survey where businesses thought that their outlook, you know, for the future was going to get really negative. And that was even just on the heels of the first earthquake. So that was March 11th. If you think about it, March was the Tonkin survey. So kind of some really mixed signals here. You know, people piling into the Nikkei because it was down. That's kind of the big play right now. If it's down, buy it, no matter what. And, you know, the catch a falling knife works for so long. We'll see how long it lasts. If, in fact, we continue to see the shutdown of the automobile manufacturers and the suppliers, you know, you're going to have a problem in Japan. And mind you, you did see the yen weaken against the dollar. Dollar strengthened to about 85 and change, and that was really kind of neat. We were actually over here short the yen, and that worked out very, very nicely. We shorted almost to the day for clients when it dropped down to about 78 number. So that was a pretty good return in a short period of time. We shorted it with an ETF. Easiest way to do those currency trades, really, is an ETF. As a matter of fact, when you talk about currencies, let me just back up for a second and talk about this. You know, currency trading is very difficult because the amount of leverage you're allowed to use and the traders that you're playing against, which, by the way, are governments a lot of times. You're trading against governments. I don't know about you, but I don't want to trade against governments. You know why? They have unlimited money. I'll tell you a quick story. I was recently on a cruise, and I decided, you know, I'm going to play in that poker tournament. I think it was a $100 buy-in, and you would buy in for $100, and you play for the first hour with unlimited buy-ins. Now, I didn't know all the rules when I first started to play that day. I mean, I knew the rules of poker and all that in a regular tournament, but I didn't realize you could have unlimited buy-ins and what would happen. So here's how it went. So you get your chips, like I think it was like 5,000 chips, and during the first few minutes, everybody's kind of playing tight and shy and just getting used to the table. And there's about 10 tables of 10 people. And now what happens is that the deep pocket guys and gals decide that they're going to work you. So what they do is they put in big bets. They figure, you know what, if we lose, we can go back to the drawing board and for another $50, get another few thousand of chips, unlimited amounts for the first hour. So if you're trying to play a game that you have a limited amount of money. Why would you have a limited amount of money? Because you want to play the game of poker by the rules. And you're playing against somebody who for the first hour has an unlimited amount of money to utilize in order to keep on buying in if they bust out. It's very difficult to play the real game of poker because you're not playing against anybody that will fold if they have a weak hand. They'll just keep on pumping in the money. And after the hour was over, the real trick was to just stay the whole hour. Somehow conserve your money and your chips, and then at the end of the hour, you could really play. But the problem is that you really couldn't do that unless you were willing to dig deep in your pocket continually. Now, that didn't ensure you, if you did that, that you'd win, because eventually you had to play the cards and play your game. Now, let's take a look at that same situation with what goes on with currencies. Let's say you have 5,000, 10,000. Maybe you want to leverage it, maybe you don't, but you want to play the currency game. And you're playing against and betting against, let's say, the euro. Well, all of a sudden, you realize on the other side of the game are other players that are playing with the euro, but they want the euro to strengthen. You want to be, you know, weaker. That's what you think is going to happen. You think that the economy in Europe is bad, and you think that there's all sorts of problems and, you know, bankruptcies and EU putting in all sorts of money and blah, 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 blah. Okay. So you got the right fundamentals, the right idea. You're playing the game like it should be played, and your theory is right, your philosophy is right, your execution is right, but then all of a sudden, you're playing against an unlimited pocketbook where they could just keep on pumping money in no matter what because they just create it out of thin air. They juggle around the books, they move it around, and they keep on pushing it to where they want it to be. So you may say, well, the game's rigged. You know what I would say to that? You're right. It is. And that goes along many of the areas of investing. But for those of you that say, well, you know, I don't want to play in a rigged game because, you know, you can get really smushed. Absolutely. There's no question about that. First of all, be careful the rigged game you're playing. Know that the parameters of what you're dealing with. Know that if you are going to be playing with Japanese stocks that they can go down so far, then Japan does have on order, on record, on ready to go, they could actually buy into the public companies of their stock market. Same thing happened with Saudi Arabia recently. Stock market in Saudi Arabia dropped 15, 18% when all the unrest was happening in the Middle East. And then one day they decide, you know, okay, it's over. We're going to, and what they do? They poured in billions of dollars into their stock market, raising up the price of stocks to help out their people. Kind of sounds a little bit familiar with what happened here. But there, they're outwardly honest about it, at least. I don't say honest. They're outwardly vocal about it. Here, we just call it different things. QE, stimulus, fiscal, you know, a loose monetary policy. You know, we have things like the banking loans that went on, you know, the discount window, et cetera. All those things are meant to do the same thing. So you say to yourself, well, why would ever a market collapse? Well, a market collapses because, you know, when things do get out of hand, you don't always have the safety net underneath it. It's only when things are just so awful and when things look like they're going to break down and just go down forever that the government does step in. You notice they never step in when things get overheating, when things are out of control, right? When things are off the charts and, you know, to help avert something. Yeah, they may increase in interest rate, et cetera, but they don't do anything as drastic as they've done now by really essentially pumping money into the system. Now, so, you know, playing the currency game can be very difficult. You have to be very careful and set some very, very tight technical parameters. Clearly, that over that 85-ish, 86 number was the point where the yen should stop moving lower. That's the number where they become profitable over in Japan from the Japanese car makers and exporters. So that's kind of a neat thing. If they were making some money at least at when the yen was 81, well, they can make some more money when it's at 85, 86. Clearly, if they're a major exporter. Now, to get to what's going on here, I'll mention a couple things. First of all, we've Alcoa coming out on Monday evening. You may be listening to this after that. We have Bank of America, JP Morgan, a variety of people opening up the earnings season next week. And we should get a good tell of what's happening by some of these companies. Now, not a full analysis because we don't really have the key players that I would like to see in technology that are going to be coming out. But we do have Alcoa, and they're the first really material company to come out with earnings during quote-unquote earnings season. And we're looking for, and I think investors are looking for, a confirmation in order to keep the trend moving higher right now above its current resistance points about the 1325 area on the S&P 500. And, you know, right now with all the things that are going and the headwinds that we have right now compared to where we saw the last two quarters, let's say, with the higher commodity costs putting in input pressure and margin compression pressure on companies. Some companies are still coming out and saying, hey, things are great. Retail sales last week surprised everybody how good they were. Stocks went up, and then immediately the big boys like a Goldman and a few others cut the estimates, figuring that this quarter was going to be the best quarter they had due to the declining consumer confidence and the input cost pressure they're going to see. Not to mention the fact that people have to be paying more for oil and gas. I saw a 413 this week for premium. I don't know what you're seeing around you, but it's been getting pretty high. So what do we do in this kind of situation where we're hitting earnings season and we have a portfolio of stocks, long or short, doesn't matter, and we're waiting? Well, I think you have to start picking up clues from the direction. Right now, the direction is clearly no direction. You know, we moved down very sharply after we saw all the things happening in the Middle East and the Tokyo or the Japan earthquake. And then we saw a big pop up. Now, the pop up came up in very mild volume, very mild volume. Even though we're clearly in directionally, very short term here, directionally up mode, rally mode, if you will, right now, you're seeing a lot of the big names start to fall apart. The names that were really the winners. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the recent strength charts of industry sectors like the industrials, consumer staples, consumer discretionary, healthcare, utilities, things of that nature, technology, what you find and what you look at is over the last several weeks, there's been this gigantic, I mean, enormous rotation from the high flyers, from the consumer related, from the technology, the growth, if you will, into the more value-oriented utilities, consumer staples, and healthcare. Have you seen some of these healthcare? We own Perrigo and Alexion. I mean, wow. Just amazing moves on many of these healthcare companies. Look at Abbott and Pfizer recently and a few others. I mean, they just came out of nowhere. And they were just wallowing and just nothingness. They were going nowhere for a while. And all of a sudden, they started to pick up. This is a classic sign of a rotation to more defensive sectors. So we take that as note one. Okay, that's interesting. That doesn't mean anybody's really doing anything that substantial. It may just be a rotation. Simply that at the beginning of a quarter, what you have, end of a quarter, beginning of a quarter, you rotate out of the best performers into your worst performers. And, you know, that's a bit of a contrarian play, but that's also a rebalancing play in portfolios, you know, for mutual funds and maybe some hedge funds. Classic play. You also have this big NASDAQ 100 rebalance. So you have a lot of things that are moving around inside of there and you're seeing extra volume. About 10% of the total holdings of anybody that owns the NASDAQ 100, whether it's an ETF or your hedge fund or maybe even a mutual fund that invests with that philosophy, has to rebalance from about a 22% position in Apple down to, I think, 12. Think how much pressure is going to be on Apple over the next month until this is a, you know, a finalized point. And I think it's May 2nd or May 5th. So when you look at that and you say, oh, there's going to definitely be some selling pressure on Apple, you have to scratch your head and wonder, do I want to be in Apple right now? Now, if you're in Apple, fine. You love Apple. Everything's great. But look at the technicals on Apple. They're not really showing up as anything that's spectacular. They're clearly in a downtrend under their 50-day moving average, and they're just not looking so great. There's some supply issues right now. You know, no new products have been announced recently, except for the fact that iPads are selling out everywhere. We know that. And everybody has an iPhone. So when you look at that and you see some of the leaders starting to fall out in some of the leading sectors and the growing sectors that have been really the charging light in this rally recently, then you have to look at that too. Look at that situation. You also have to look at, okay, what's happening on the economic front? Well, you're seeing that in Europe, all sorts of horrible things, except for Germany. Let's just kind of focus in on everything ex-Germany. You're seeing inflation hit, you know, a continual high in England, and they're talking about increasing rates, although they didn't because they're scared about, you know, markets and all that. They, you know, these Fed officials, and whether they're the ECB or here or over there, you know, they are so nervous about these markets lately. They're so scared that the wealth effect is going to disintegrate and cause all sorts of problems for markets that they're just not willing to take any moves. Now, yeah, the ECB did take a quarter point move or so last week, and markets were okay with it. It was terribly expected. It was a move that I think that was more for showmanship to show there was strength there, which, frankly, I don't think there is. And on top of that, it was to help, again, strengthen the euro. They're big into the strengthening of the euro and, at the same time, helping to inflate assets around the world. They actually, I think, in a pact, this call me crazy, but I think in a pact with Bernanke and the gang over here, they're in a pact to really crush the dollar every way they can in order to really inflate the value of assets around the world. It makes no other sense. I mean, the inflation really isn't that bad over there, 2.6% overall in the region. I mean, big deal. And that's the core inflation. That's not even ex, you know, the energy and ex food like we have here. Which clearly, if we do the same thing, we're in the same boat, but they don't want to increase over here. So what happens? The dollar collapses. Oil goes flying higher in the face of continuing unrest in Libya and in the Middle East. And even in the face of a very bearish inventory number from the DOE on Wednesday morning. So what you have here is a momentum trade that's not stopping. Easy money that you could leverage on utilizing futures in the petroleum markets. The dollar getting squashed every way possible, except for against the yen, because we are continually squawking about a very easy policy. As a matter of fact, this weekend, Yellen came out and said, you know, hey, I don't care what they say. There's no stopping this QE. That's a paraphrase. Even though we've had a few hawkish commentaries recently saying, you know what, we really don't think, two different Fed officials last week, you know, I don't know if we really need to do the rest of the QE. Yellen comes out on Sunday just to mop the floor with them and say, oh, come on. Yes, we are going to make sure to continue with this asset purchases because the economy is still too fragile. Now, what's really interesting is, we've talked about this before, what part of the economy is fragile? I mean, is it corporations? Well, not really. They keep coming out with great numbers for the most part. EPS this quarter in the S&P 500 will be the highest it's been in, I don't know how long, years, if not ever. Growth has been great. Balance sheets are strong. They are meeting all their numbers. So what do we have here? We really have the employment situation, which is, you know, got a little bit better, but let's just say it really hasn't moved from close to 9% or so up a little bit above, a little bit below for months and months and months, clearly in recessionary levels. Yeah, sure, we could say it's the lagging indicator. But you know what? It's kind of important, obviously, to have as much employment as you can here. But you know what? Hello? Hello, Fed officials? Could someone answer the phone? Hello? Let me tell you something. You have a structural unemployment problem that will not be solved by any kind of fiscal federal stimulus. No easy policy is going to help because the workers here are too expensive. They've been replaced. They've been replaced by cheap workers in China and Asia and India and some parts of Europe. They've been replaced by all sorts of robotics and automation. They've been replaced by technology. So what is it that they're trying to do? If you really break it down, it looks like the Fed is trying to break us. The Fed is doing everything they can to kill the dollar. I mean, look at gold at an all-time high price. Silver is rocketing. Again, we saw that food prices have moved up again to an all-time high, even though they came down a little bit, but then they went right back up. All of this is because commodities become much more expensive when the dollar sinks. So when you look at that and you look around the world and you see that while the dollar is sinking, some of those other currencies are rising, you know, you have to wonder, what is it and where is it going to end? Does the stock market just fall apart because we have no additional Fed easing? I just can't imagine that's going to happen if the corporate environment and, you know, the world of where we look at the stock market companies are doing much better than they were. And if you really think about it, if they stop with the quantitative easing and they stop with the easy policy and just raise a little bit, maybe we can get just a little bit of a break on the commodity prices increasing, which will do a whole heck of a lot for everybody, including companies. So it really is a wild situation that we have here that is so much opposite of the rest of the world. Now, let's get back to Europe for a second. In Europe, what we saw was the continuation of their, well, how do we say this? I guess their bull poop. Keep this G-rated. I mean, you know, have you ever seen so many lies come out of so many people on a regular basis? What am I talking about? Well, we saw that same thing happened with Greece and Italy, Ireland. But Greece did this. It started with Greece. You know, we don't need a bailout. We don't need a, everything's fine. We're doing austerity. Everything's fine. We don't need a bailout. No. We need a bailout. Okay, fast forward. Portugal. We don't need a bailout. Everything is fine. We are going to vote on austerity. Okay, they declined it. They don't want the austerity. Well, okay, fine. We don't need a bailout. Why do they keep saying that? Why do you see these, either the presidents of the Federal Reserves over there, of the various countries or the economic chiefs or the prime minister, whoever it is, why do they keep coming out and saying they don't need a bailout and they're doing fine, they're making progress? You know why? Especially the timing of this one. Even though they were downgraded multiple times by Moody's and Standard & Poor's and Fitch and all that, because they have bonds to sell. Can you imagine having a car, a used car, and you go sell it? And you know that there's, you know, the engine kind of sputters a little bit. But, you know, all right. And you had some paint job done. But you really can't notice it too much. And you go to sell it. And the guy comes, hey, what do you want for the car? Oh, you tell him, how's it running? Runs good. Runs great. Any problems? Nothing really. No, nothing. You know, I mean, it's an older car, so you got your things here and there. And any major, you know, thing? No, a little touch up here. Yeah, but you know what? It's a five-year-old car, and it is what it is. Can you start it up? Sure, you start it up. It runs okay and all that. You know, it's only when you get over 45 miles an hour and blah, 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 that it does whatever it does wrong and things like that. But you know what? You keep up your commentary about how it's a great car. It served you well. It's gotten you back and forth. It's reasonable miles on it. And boy, you love this thing and you hate to give it up. And you convince the guy to buy it. Then you go back to your friends and say, you know, thank God I got rid of that thing. Ooh, man, that was a close one. I don't know when that thing was going to die. I'm glad I got rid of it. It's off my mind. We'll go on to the next thing. Now, Portugal, they do the same thing. They say, you know, everything's fine. The austerity measures are kicking in. We have enough money. We'll be able to go to the market and get issues and bonds and renew our bonds, which a lot are coming due next year. And we don't want help. We are not in talks with the IMF. We're not in talk with the EU. We're not in talk with anybody. And if anybody said it, it's an outright lie. And then they do their bond offering. And then 2 days later, hello, you know, guys, I think we need a bailout. We are in talks with the IMF. Wow. You're telling me that from last week to this week, you all of a sudden need a bailout? What changed? You knew the rates you were going to get in the bond market when you went to the auctions. You knew the numbers because that's what it was. You pushed as much as you could at those numbers and then realized that there's no way you're going to be able to pay that debt. How beautiful is this? There's no way you're going to be able to pay that debt because the austerity measures haven't kicked in or are not going to kick in. You know that the taxing power of your authority is not going to be able to meet the obligations. So you basically go and pick up bonds, flush yourself with money, and then offload the deal on the EU because you know that there's no way that you can do this deal. How great is that? I mean, how great is that? Meanwhile, all of a sudden going, oh, yeah, things look good. And the euro keeps on rising. They keep on looking at bailout after bailout. The Irish banks, now they change the rules on what qualifies for EU participation because the EU has been downgraded, each of the individual countries, not even, but many of them. And even Germany is looking at a downgrade if they keep on pumping money into this never-ending cesspool of toxic debt that's on the books of Spain, Ireland, Greece, Portugal, Spain. And now even England may be dragged into this whole deal. Iceland this weekend said, screw you. We're not paying you back. We know you bailed us out. We know you bailed out these banks for foreigners and all that. And we have a contract. But you know what? We voted no. We're reversing our older decision. We're not paying you back. Now, you gave us these unbelievable rates that we have to pay back between now, I think starting in 2020 to 2046, which was an extension from like 2015 to 2025. But you know what? We don't want that either because we know that you guys are suckers. We know you're going to have to eat this. We know you're not going to let us go under because at this point, it's a game of chicken, isn't it? Already Saab's being bailed out, looking for some loans. Now, TEPCO, the Japanese nuclear utility, will be bailed out potentially by Japan. I mean, what is going on? It's like a never-ending horror story of mismanagement. Japan's situation is, well, I'll take that back. The Japanese utility in the news talked about how 2 years ago they could have done an enhancement to their overall, the walls to restrain any major waves from tsunamis. But they felt that while it was important that it wasn't feasibly possible to do right now. Well, looking back, it probably was a lot cheaper than what happened. But nonetheless, when you look at all this, it's just bad management. And then I guess we got to look at, you know, the way that governments are thinking these days. There's a coordinated effort around the world to just BS the people and play a confidence game and look for that the whole thing just to kind of sweep it under the rug and hopefully it will be fine. I've talked to a good friend, Sanjay Das, many times. Right, he's been on here and he talks about how the European region is just in terrible shape. And time again, he's been right. But yet the euro has been rallying, or better said, the dollar has been dropping, which just shows you how pathetic our situation is here when it comes to monetary policy and our economics outlook. The other thing I'll mention is that what I found really kind of odd, I guess, was that when you look at the policy that we have here and you look at the budget and the debt and all that, did you see, you couldn't have not seen, that spectacle of that 11th, I mean, truly, when I say it's literally, the 11th hour vote on the budget to carve out, I don't know, a couple of percent out of the total trillion dollars worth of budget that's out there. And now you have, you know, $38, $40 billion this year that's being cut out of it. That's great. But the spectacle that they made to themselves and the inability for anybody to get things done was horrifying. That didn't help the dollar. That was one of the reasons that oil spiked so much on Friday, because the dollar just got slammed. On Thursday night, when they said they couldn't make a decision at this point, the dollar just got decimated. Euro screamed higher. The yen went higher. The gold went higher. Silver went higher. Commodities went higher. Oil went higher. And the stock market was like, uh-oh, we're getting a little bit too frothy on this whole oil issue, and now it may start affecting economic conditions. This $1 move, $2 move does that. Kind of reach a threshold. You're like, that's enough. Can't go any higher than that because now we're really going to be hurting. So what's going to be up next for this administration, Congress? Well, you have the debt ceiling. Hello, that's going to be fun. Going to have this talk over the next couple of weeks of the debt ceiling, which is going to obviously be very problematic. Timothy Geithner said recently, he said, you know, this could be catastrophic economic uncertainty and conditions and problems if the debt ceiling is allowed to be held and not raised. Because already we need to issue more debt to pay for whatever the heck we're paying for. That just keeps on going on and on. And we're out. We're at the top end. We've maxed out our United States credit card. And we're calling up the company and saying, hey, you know what? Well, we know we don't have the money to pay you back right now. We think that, you know, because interest rates are so low, we can keep issuing bonds. And if we do so, we'll be able to do it at low rates. And, you know, that's going to eventually help the budget long term because we'll be paying a lot less interest on it. But at the same time, we need to increase our line of credit. And in the laws, they can't. So they're going to have to increase it. At least so they say. And this is going to be another major battle that is going to be very disruptive to not only currencies, but potentially world markets. And then let's take that one step further. The Republicans are about to ram in a suggestion, resolution, law, or at least try, to repeal the healthcare laws. I'm not kidding. They got a little bit in. They got their foot in the door at the midterm elections, and they are cracking that door right open right now. And they want no part of what happened recently. They want spending cuts. They want, well, they want some tax cuts also, which I don't, you know, that's kind of a little bit strange. Because, you know, you'd think that if they're doing the right thing, they should probably keep tax where they are or raise them a little bit, but not have tax cuts. But okay. But they're getting rid of some of the deductions, at least in Paul Ryan's bill. And then what you have is this repeal or at least this change of Medicare. And it just goes on and on. You really just want to throw up from all these things that the government has done over the last 3 or 4 years. It seems like it's never ending. Not to mention that we don't seem to have a plan, do we? I mean, we enter a war. We don't even know what the heck we're doing there. We don't have an out. We're stuck. Do we not know how much firepower they had on Gaddafi's side in Libya? I mean, what the heck? Are we just trying to save the oil prices? Well, we didn't do so good at that, folks, because you know what? Forget about the war. We're doing everything we can to boost oil prices by the degradation of the U.S. dollar. So you know what? What war are we fighting? You want to fight a war? Fight the war on escalation of prices. Now, obviously, we don't want anybody to get hurt, wounded, killed, you know, people who are innocent in foreign countries around the world. I mean, because, you know, we are the world's, police. I don't know who ever made that rule up, but we are. Nobody else will even step in. Now we got NATO, but we're NATO. Isn't it kind of ridiculous? Kind of stupid after a while. You know, when are we going to ever take care of home? You know, what do they say? Charity begins at home? When are we going to ever take care of this place? Instead of basically just letting it fall apart while we go around the world, try to gallivant, making friends with everybody, which obviously, with all due respect, Mr. Obama, hasn't worked so well. The Republicans are pissing off everybody. The Democrats are pissing off everybody. And trust me when I say there's nobody else. Now even Donald Trump is talking about being president. How would that be? Oh, my. I mean, oh, my. Can you imagine Donald Trump as president? I mean, that would be, it would be a hoot, let's say that. But you want to talk about really getting people angry? That would anger the world. I mean, he is vocal and he is aggravated. He is animated and he would really stir the pot. But nonetheless, I think that when you look at, you know, where we've gone and where we're going, the stock market, all that whole discussion just now was all about the fact that there are headwinds for the stock market. I think that a lot of people are expecting earnings to be very good, and you have to watch for disappointments here. So when you look at what's happening, look at the action. Let's take a look over the next couple of weeks at the leaders, the general direction of the market. Let's see if there's any separation due to political situations around the world and if the earnings levels are going to start to hurt a little, you know, or help. If we can break through on the top end, some nice volume, a real good momentum flow above that 1330-ish, 1340-ish range on the S&P 500. Hey, great. You can see individual stocks, of course, doing different things. You know, you'll see somebody that will beat estimates, but the whisper number was high, estimates and the whisper number was higher, and they get really whacked, and vice versa. And so that recently with consumer confidence, which has been trailing down, it hit an ungodly number last Tuesday. Stock market was upset about it for about 5 minutes and then went up because the commentary was, hey, it wasn't as bad as we expected. What do you mean it wasn't as bad as you expected? We see the analyst estimates. We know the numbers. Of course it was. It was worse. Otherwise, the analyst would have estimated lower. I mean, this is the kind of rhetoric you hear out there. The other thing I want to mention, and something that's kind of, I don't know if this has got you going, but I read a couple of news articles with, you know, Bloomberg and a variety of places, Wall Street Journal and Barron's, and I am so frustrated with the news media just taking whatever is said, not doing any checks, finding out alternate sources, and just whatever is being said, like the Portugal situation where they didn't need a bailout, and just reporting it. I guess we went backwards. No longer do we have journalists that are really looking for the story. They're looking just to throw some crap on a piece of paper for people to read. You know why? Because these days it's all about clicks. So you throw some kind of crap on a piece of paper, but you do it a lot of paper. You get more people to click. More people to click, the more you get paid. So the news items, because the ads and all that on the sites, are being paid by the click. So you don't have time really to research the story like you did any before, because you're just going to put one story up where you could have put three or four stories up with this crap in it. So you take the word of the Portuguese prime minister, and you say, okay, yeah, they don't need a bailout. Everything's great. Just write it down. You don't say anything to the contrary. You don't get alternate opinions. You don't say something like, you know, wow, that's weird. Now they need a bailout. Just a couple of days they were talking about this. Let's go through some of the math on this. Nope, doesn't happen anymore. But then what we do is we elevate the journalists into people that we actually doing stories on. I mean, wow. Crazy, right? We're interviewing the journalists or the reporters. We're interviewing the reporters who are just spitting out the information of the people that are trying to feed it to them and push it out to the public. How stupid. I think that's the theme of the show, how stupid. All right, let's talk about China for a second. China actually has been going after tightening again and again recently. They're trying their best to raise banking reserves. They're trying their best to increase interest rates reserve requirements and interest rates. And what's really kind of, I thought, very interesting over the weekend was that China saw their first trade deficit since 2004. Now, Timothy Geithner miraculously has been holding back the note. You know that note. The one that says, by the Congress, we're charging you with currency manipulation, China. And I don't know how they say that with a straight face, but nonetheless, they say, China, you're a currency manipulator. You're not letting yuan rise as much as it should. If it does, it's good for consumption internally, and it will help out the rest of the world. Your reserves are much more out of whack. Your economy is much stronger. And your yen should be, your yuan, your currency should be much, much higher. Okay. So what does China do? They released the float, the lock. So now you got a floating rate that they have a little bit of a range that they are allowing it to move, but it's moved up. Yuan has definitely moved up over the last several months. And now, once again, the idea that the currency is still being manipulated has been brought to light just last week. And Timothy Geithner decided that he is not going to send a letter until after another G7 or G20 meeting coming up. I don't know why. He keeps it in his breast pocket, I guess, when he calls up and says, hey, by the way, just to let you know, we got this letter that we're going to release. It's a secret. Nobody knows about it, but everybody knows about it. That the Congress is calling you officially and branding you a currency manipulator. I'm sure China on the other end of the phone is saying, huh? What? You're what? So? And what does that mean? We're not doing anything about it anyway. And your plan is stupid. You're killing your dollar and you call us a currency manipulator? I mean, come on. Now, so what does China do? Well, one of the big problems has been that China has been having a trade surplus for years. Huge numbers, just tremendous numbers, where their exports have been outstripping their imports by a gigantic number. Well, we don't like that. We want them to import. We want them to import from us. How do we do that? Well, either one of two ways. We can either ask them and politely to please, you know, please import. That's probably not going to work. We could say we have superior products. That's probably not going to work. We could ask them to raise their yuan and make our goods cheaper. Or, of course, we could drop the dollar somehow, kill a dollar, make it so much cheaper to buy from us. That's interesting. So what does China do? They come out with a report. Miraculous. The first trade deficit where they have much more by a few hundred million of imports than they do exports. Wow. So guess what? Timothy Geithner probably will get to keep his little letter in his pocket for a little while longer. Now, whether or not we believe the numbers from China, I don't know. I don't care. Because it is what it is. So all we could look at is the numbers they provide. You know, we don't like the numbers. We say that they were made up. When we like them, we say, yeah, they're solid. So Timothy Geithner was stuffed again, so to speak, by China, showing that, hey, you know what? It's working. We are increasing our imports, and the yuan is moving up slightly, not terribly. And we're also doing our best to, you know, rein in all of the speculation on housing and on commodities. We stopped doing a massive amount of bulking up on many of the commodities. They did a lot of that for a while, although they just bought everything they could in cotton recently. Just jammed the price of cotton. As a matter of fact, they bought over the ask price on cotton recently. Curious. They must be getting big orders for either pants, or they know something about the crop, or who knows. Or maybe they just, you know, want to have some extra around. But, you know, this is kind of the thing they do. They know they're going to use these commodities in the manufacturing areas, so they do their best to bulk up on it. So all that being said, it's kind of like this gigantic world action that's been really moving markets in the last 6 weeks, we'll call it. And now we'll see if there's going to be a break with that, and we start looking at fundamentals again. This usually does happen during the quiet periods between earnings seasons. You see some other factors that come up that become the focal point. But let's take a look then, finally, when we know fundamentals, we know world politics, what's happening with the technicals? What's happening with the technical indicators, or at least the technical look of the various markets? Well, the Russell 2000, the small caps, hit an all-time high last week and then dropped right back down. So they're hitting some significant resistance from their all-time high territory, but they had some real good power going in there. You know, we think that the dropping dollar is you know, really creating a problem for them, because the price of input prices for small caps is much more difficult. They can't do all the giant inventory stocking up, if you will, on smaller companies. So small caps can kind of get hurt with that. Plus, you know, there's a lot of expectations that went into these small caps, and they really ramped up pretty well the last several months. So that could be a risk-off trade right now. Then you have the S&P 500. We drop to the 50-day line. We pop right back above. Very low volume. Hitting resistance, kind of flatlining there. And right now vacillating within a pretty much consolidating market condition. Again, looks like it can go either way. What happens? Well, it looks like the rally that we've been in, you know, could very well continue. Whether you want to believe it or not, that's what the technicals are telling you. You have a rising 50-day, you have a rising 200-day, the 200-day is over the 50-day. You have things like some trending indicators that clearly are pointing not to oversold at this point. McClellan actually dipped back to zero, so never got too overbought there, but that's because the market's kind of crapped out in the end of last week. And you have the right now kind of the make it or break it. Really, right now, starting next week or so, we're going to have the make it or break it for the markets. You're going to have either the markets break down because earnings are just not there. A lot of announcements come out. We didn't see a lot of pre-announcements this time around. Kind of companies are keeping it close to the vest, either because they're real excited or they're real nervous. Real nervous of providing some bad numbers and how the stock can drop, or real excited about how, you know, they're going to really outshine and move things higher. So I think that when we look at this, you know, you have to look at the situation as, one that is, I think, multifaceted. And you have to watch the technicals if it does roll and where is it going to go to. That 50-day line has been a great support mechanism, a little bit above it, a little bit below it, for the broader markets. That shows you a sign of institutional support. We talked about that. So how are we investing? Well, depending on the portfolio, depending on how we invest, you know, we have both more traditional portfolios where we manage assets of $500,000 or more. you know, we have investments there. We have some bonds in there. We have some hedges in there with regard to we had the yen in there till last week. We have some we're short the long bond, the long treasury. We have some core bonds in there, some quality bonds. We also have some value and growth. You know, we definitely have a very good diversification that's been working. Then you kind of step it up to the more aggressive side. We have about 65% or so in equities and some cash, just waiting to see if we do see a breakout to kind of ride it real quick. And if not, we're going to put on a quick hedge, whether we use an ETF or an option. Right now, the VIX is picked up a little bit last week, but it dropped down into the 16s again mid last week. Not a lot of fear out there. So, you know, where should you be going? I think you should be looking for the companies with the strongest fundamentals right now, especially right now. And I think you should be looking at for those that are in a continuing uptrend that have some support lines that are not too far away so that you can, you know, if they do start dipping, you can, you know, clearly see where those are, have a rising trend line overall, not being overbought, and have some volume recently coming in on the upside. The worst thing you could see is a stock that has a rising move on just awful, awful volume because they're just riding up at the markets. Where does that get you? As soon as it cracks, it gets down and gets beaten down hard. So you got to be really careful of that condition right there. Again, we saw the same thing with the market, but it's potentially okay for a market to have lower volume, but not ideal. You want to see increasing volume. You want to see an increasing situation when it comes to the market volume overall. But that's not what we're seeing in this last upswing. As a matter of fact, right before that, we saw significant distribution. Then again, Friday, we saw distribution day on the market, but not from a volume standpoint. We saw it move lower, but volume was nothing. It was lower than the day before. So I think it was just non-participation, moving around of things, a little churning. There's also the fact that they couldn't reach a budget deal. So we'll see what happens, you know, as we see the as the Congress turns, if you will. So lots going on right now. We're going to find out more about some of the technicals next week with Kevin DePew. And we're going to also reach out to Das again to talk about the market conditions in Europe and see what happens there. It would seem likely that the euro should start to weaken if we see any kind of good news out of the U.S. and if we can get Congress to stop fiddle-faddling and the president arguing and everybody just all, you know, all over the place with this. If we can actually start to slow down the spending and get some agreement, maybe the dollar will stabilize. We kind of know, you know, how much, at least at this point, how much is going to be used for QE, and the dollar looks a little bit oversold here, I must tell you, from a lot of different indications. But, you know, we have to look at the world and say, you know, how much love is there for the dollar right now? There's just not. But one thing we do know, and I think that we could fairly say, that if the dollar does start to strengthen, we could see a very significant drop in gold and in oil. Very significant. Because the dollar has been the major contributor to a lot of this move, but also the uncertainty. Once you get some time that goes on and you get the initial feelings of concern out of the way, oil still has a lot of inventory out there. So we're going to look into, looking into, not doing it because you don't want to go against this current very strong trend. But if it starts to roll over a little bit, we may look to short some oil. Could be an interesting play for you too. Anyway, with that in mind, of course, any questions you have, you can just write me anytime you want at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And, of course, if you want to check out some of the work that we do, you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We write a lot there. We write some economic discussions. We're not writing for clicks, by the way. We don't get paid for clicks there. We write some economic commentary. We write about stocks. We write about just things that are happening out there, rants or loves or, you know, a whole bunch of things that go on in the markets, all market-related, of course. Great links to where you can find other things. Also, podcast notes for all the information we talk about here. Check that out, and, we will endeavor to figure this all out. I'm looking forward to providing a good deal of information next week, so stay tuned for that with kind of after the look of what happens during earnings week, the first week of earnings. That's going to give us a great tell, and we'll try to bring you a couple of different ideas on what to do there, and maybe some real actionable ideas with Kevin DePew. He's great at technical analysis over from Minionville. So with that in mind, I bid you adieu. Have a great weekend. A little bit of a short show today. We didn't have a guest lined up. I don't know what happened. We had a couple of guys that rescheduled. So I thought I'd spend some time with you talking about some of the fundamental things about what's happening around the world. Hopefully you enjoyed it. We'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me again. It's Andrew Horowitz saying bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.